Welcome once again to the Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey, Communications Director. Jay Abraham, have to ask you briefly about your revering yourself. When in your career did you understand the importance of that, and explain what it is?
Well, Marty, it's a philosophy that I think is probably the springboard or the real lever that gets most people to jump explosively up to a higher and then maybe a higher level of performance. It's based on the fact that most people complain about how little respect they get, how little people value what they do, how little people appreciate them. But if they don't value themselves and they don't revere themselves and they don't start the beginnings of any relationship by positioning themselves in a way where their customer or their prospect or their employer or their employee has the utmost and profound appreciation for them, if they don't continue that reverence process all along, they cannot expect any different outcome. I learned one of the greatest lessons, and as a gift to the subscribers to The Edge, we're going to include it actually on this tape. We're going to splice it in as a permanent reference for everybody. But when I was in Australia, I was impacted profoundly by a man. I wish I could tell you I taught him. He actually taught me. The man is a dentist. And in Australia, the average dentist, they work 60 hours to make approximately $60,000 Australian, about $45,000. They work their hearts out and they don't make a lot of money. This dentist works 23 hours and makes approximately $400,000. And he does it by changing the rules he plays the game of dentistry by. Most dentists basically take everybody, and it's a very predictable and a very medicinal, no pun intended, type of environment. He changed the rules. He used to operate at conventional dentistry, and about three-quarters of his patients he loathed. They weren't pleasant. They didn't pay their bills. They didn't come with frequency. They only came when they had problems. They were late for their appointments. They were everything that made him... He didn't enjoy their company. They were like nonplussed as far as human beings, and he just didn't enjoy them in the context of rendering a service. He purged them. It took an incredible leap of faith. He purged everybody but the people he thoroughly enjoyed, and he enjoyed them on one of a couple of criteria. They were either extremely delightful people to have as patients. They paid their bills. They were there on time. They were preventatively oriented. And he decided those were the exact kind of people he wanted the entirety of his practice predicated on. So he started a process where in the beginning, from the very beginning, he changed the rules of the game he played. When anybody came as a new patient to his practice, he sat down with them and spent approximately 15 minutes interviewing them and being interviewed by them. He got rid of his waiting room in the standard context and gutted it and turned it into five salons, basically booths like a restaurant. He got a part-time chef to cook for him and bake breads and rolls and muffins in the morning, so that it was a really nice smelling and a nice context of the environment. When anyone came in, he would sit down with a new patient. He would sit down for approximately 15 minutes. He'd start off by overviewing what he thought they should expect out of their dentist. And that expectation was predicated on a lot of different factors. Number one, they should expect their dentist to schedule appointments and live by them. Number two, they should expect their dentist to worry about them at a higher level than they would worry about themselves. Number three, they should expect their dentist to perform services at such a level of professionalism and artistry and craftsmanship that the work was superlative and endured. Number five, they should expect their dentist to no way, shape, or form render any pain to them and be gentle and respectful. Number six, they should expect their dentist to worry about them as if they were a member of the family. He went on with a litany of things. And he basically said, he drew the picture, he focused what they should expect. The next thing he did was turn the table and say, here's what I, as your dentist, should expect from you. Number one, I should expect if you're going to be my patient, you revere and treasure the importance of your teeth and your oral health and your oral hygiene, and you respect the fact that we're in this together to keep your teeth solid and enduring and in your mouth and healthy for your whole life. Number two, I expect you to schedule with me and honor those appointments on a regular basis to take good preventative maintenance. Number three, when you make an appointment, I expect you to show up. Number four, if you come to that appointment, I expect you to be there on time, never be late. If I render the service that you expected of me, I expect you to tender the payment right there on the spot. I don't want to send you a bill. I don't want to have to worry about you. Number five, I want to be your friend, and I want you to be my friend. I want you to care about me at the level I care about you, and I don't want our relationship just to be professional. I want us to care about each other in a deep and fraternal level. I want to know about your family. I want to know about your life. I want to know about your hopes, your dreams. I don't just want to come and think in the limitations of your mouth. Number six, if you are satisfied and I perform the way you expect in the first session we have together, I expect between then and a month from there you to refer to me at very least three patients of similar quality and value system as you, because that's the you habitate with the kind of people I want as clients or patients. Consequently, you are the best source. And when I say refer to me, I don't want you to give me the names. You must call them up. You must extol my virtues. You must basically compel them to call my office and get on the waiting list, because we do have a waiting list. And if you fail to do that, I'll have to charge you more, because it means I have to expend more effort and money in marketing my practice. So he changed the whole rules, Marty.
Wow. Now, should we listen to that now?
Yes, we should listen to it right now. And I should tell you prior to that, that at all the expensive training programs I do, the 5, the 10, the 15, the 25, I play that. And I play it 4 times. I have sent it out to people in all kinds of businesses who don't realize the value of referrals. Referrals are the highest level of acknowledgement of the value you have in people's eyes, and it's a process I do particularly strong in the real estate business. I've changed people's businesses from being non-referral to being 80% referral, and in the process reduced their marketing cost and effort by as much as 90 to 100% to zero. I have improved the average unit of sale and the profitability by as much as 4 times. The philosophy of listening to this tape is that you have to revere yourself, and you have to think transactionally past the limitations of what you normally do generically. You've got to look at the impact and the influence what you do has on somebody's lives, so you can appreciate the powerful relevancy of your importance, your reverence, your value to them. It's not just I sell, in the dentist case, I sell dentistry. It's the fact that if you come to me, I will keep your teeth in your mouth healthy for the rest of your life. You will not have to wear dentures. You will not be anything but maximum attractive. If there's a problem, I will keep you cosmetically beautiful or handsome or distinguished and proud and confident, because you'll always be proud to open your mouth, because you'll know you look great. You'll always feel great. If there is a problem, I will take care of it in a way that will never come back to haunt you. It'll be done right, and it will always be done the same way I would do it for my own family. And if you look at whatever it is you do, the listener, in business, and you try to transcend the limitations of viewing yourself as a generic commodity and expand to viewing yourself as a creator of transformational value for people, and you ask yourself this question: what are the impact or the influences my service or product properly rendered or used has on somebody's life? In the real estate industry, which I can give you a good example, I ask realtors to talk about what the influence has been. They basically, most of them have such a low self-image, they just look at themselves as salespeople or agents selling or listing or buying or selling or representing property. And I said, that's not what you do. You make it possible for someone's entire life to be changed. In the buying capacity, you help somebody move to a higher level of lifestyle in a neighborhood that gives them more joy. You gave them a chance to create for themselves an incredible appreciating asset that will maybe pay for their retirement. You've enabled their family and their children to live and flourish in an environment that's more stimulating, where they have a higher probability probably of success, of happiness. You've done so many things. And maybe in the process, you've helped them negotiate an acquisition on that house that was $50,000 or $70,000 or $100,000 less than they may have been asking and that those people were initially willing to pay. That $100,000 is enough to pay the moving expenses, pay for their children's college, save them probably $1,000 a month for 30 years in mortgage payments. All of those factors are issues that you have to revere if you're going to revere yourself and the impact of what you do and its influence on somebody's life. And that really applies to anybody selling anything tangibly, intangibly, product or service. Until and unless you revere the implication of what you do on somebody's life, and not just the generic basis, but the transactional and the transformational and the implicational aspects, you can't begin to respect and hold yourself in high enough esteem. If all you see you do is being a merchant of things, that doesn't really give you a lot of confidence in yourself. If you see the things you sell change people's lives and the implications of how they change people's lives, that starts getting really exciting. Does that make sense to you, Marty? I asked this question. I want to make sure if I'm not clear that you challenge me and you ask for illustration, but I think that that's the greatest gift of summary I can give somebody, and they should listen to this tape at least 4 or 5 times. In it, the man tells the posture, he tells the philosophy, he tells what happened in his own life, and he gives a really neat, simple, little strategic philosophy that you can apply to anything you do. And if you listen to it, I've this single tape, which is all of maybe 8 minutes, has impacted more profoundly more people than you'll ever imagine. And I'd like to hope that it will do the same for the people listening to it here. I recommend, commend, and urge everybody listening to listen to it multiples of one time, at least 4 or 5. It has made incalculable, positive, and profitable, and intangible impacts on almost everybody at my expensive programs I've ever shared it with. It was the result of me getting to know somebody well enough that he revealed to me a transactional philosophy that has enabled him to earn whatever 60 is, 400,000 is to 60, almost 6.5 times the average income of his industry, working approximately 2/3 less time and having total control of his destiny, operating in an environment of pure pleasure and joy with people he thoroughly enjoys being with, and having a glorious time in the process, where he looks more forward to Monday mornings than he does Friday. And that's something that I think very few people listening to this tape could say about their situation right now.
Well, let's listen.
Okay.
In my business, I only take people by referral. And the way that I started doing that was initially by asking people for referral, and that was fairly scary to say to somebody, would you ask one of
your... It's awkward too, wasn't it?
It's awkward, it's scary, it's intimidating, and it makes you feel a little small somehow. And then somewhere, and I'm sure somebody gave me the idea, but I can't remember who, but thank you whoever gave it to me, somebody said, or some little part of my brain said, what about if you tell people that they've got to refer people to you?
And that was, what if you make that a condition of doing business with you, is what you're saying?
Yeah. When someone becomes a client of mine, I sit them down and I say, hey, before you can become a client of mine, we have this little bargain that I would like to run past you. And one part of the bargain is that I owe an awful lot of things to you because you've decided to become a client of mine. And the other part of it is, because you've become a client of mine, you owe me some things. And one of the things that you owe me is to refer to me 2 people of comparable quality to yourself. And the reason is...
Don't minimize. Say that again, because I think you like Mike saying, oh yeah, by the way, $600 million came from that little idea.
2 people of comparable quality to yourself. And
because he's raising them to a height of acknowledgement and special. They're special to him. They're not the norm. His clients are a special elite breed, right?
They are special because they've been referred by other clients of mine.
Similar to them.
Yeah, similar to them, of comparable quality to them.
My
clients. And so I say, I require you that you do this before you join the practice. And when I first said that, I thought, oh, it's a bit scary. I'll probably get 50%, and that's pretty good. And in actual fact, the common response is, can I only refer you 2 people? Which I thought was an interesting response. It's not
Now, why do you think they responded that way? Because they don't know the rules, and if you tell them these are the rules and you lead them, they'd say, hey, that must be the way to do it.
Structured before they come. I try and destroy their concepts of what it means to be in my particular business.
Tell everybody how you do that.
Well, whenever you run a business, whenever we run a business, we tend to copy the other people that run the same sort of business.
Why?
Because this is just the way it is. We do it in law.
There's no reason for it, though, is there? Is there a rule that says, is there a law that if you deviate one iota, you're going to be fined $5 trillion Australian dollars and sent to Tasmania for a week? I mean, I'm just asking.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. But we act as if there is a law like that in Australia. So we act as if we have to run our business exactly the same as everybody else has run their business. But we don't. And nothing happens awfully if we don't run our business in the same way. So I decided to destroy people's paradigms by changing my way of business. And one of the things that I did was I locked my front door so that people couldn't get in. And that makes it a little different. Does it make a difference? Yeah.
Do they have to ring a buzzer?
You got to ring the bell. And there's a little sign on the door that says, thank you for calling, we're inside, but we can't do much unless you've been referred by someone who's already a client of ours. So if you've been referred or if you're a client of ours, please ring the bell. Otherwise, if you have a major problem, we'll try and find somebody who will help you, but we won't help you. I'm a dentist.
He's a brain surgeon.
Yeah, okay, a brain surgeon. I work on people's brains, yeah, and emotions. If you hold yourself out to be exclusive, people tend to want to get it. It's really weird, isn't it?
Continue.
Well, no, this is snobbery, but that's part of it.
I believe the vast majority of the people in this room don't revere themselves. You don't hold yourself to a high enough standard of appreciation, valuation, and acknowledgement for what you do and the value, the benefit, and the worth it has to the customer you're rendering. If it really is worthless, you should probably evaluate seriously going into a different business. If it has worth, if it has value, if it has benefit, you should think how you can enhance it and make it proprietary, but respect yourself. Okay, put it back on.
I think you've made the point I want.
Thank you.
But no, you have, but it's brilliant. But the point is, let me add on it, and you can stand, and you can be a vivid illustration. I submit to you that if you don't revere yourself, nobody will. If you don't hold yourself to a higher standard, how can you be frustrated? How in the world can you possibly have the audacity or the right to be frustrated because your customer doesn't appreciate and respect and understand you if you don't hold yourself to a higher standard? Don't you think, Fanny?
Absolutely.
But when you do and you don't do it, you got to do it with finesse, and you got to do it with education, you got to do it nurturously, and you got to do it very deftly. But when you do, they can't respect you if you don't give them a basis for that, can they?
No. If we don't love ourselves, it's hard for other people to love us. In fact,
And respect.
Yeah, or anything almost.
And our time and our ability.
Yes.
And the result.
You position yourself almost wherever you want. You know that very well.
I've read about it somewhere.
Is that okay?
That was great.
Thank you, Jay.
Thank you.
Jay, that is just an incredible tape. I can understand why so many people have been impacted by that.
I'm very fortunate that I was able, through the interviewing process and the trust process, to get him to summarize in such a short, clear manner, Marty, the base essence of what has transformed his whole life, his business, his income, his posture, his positioning, his self-worth and his self-assurance. He went from a dentist who was very, very unhappy to one of the happiest, most exhilarated men I've ever met in my life. And this basically embodies the whole philosophy in all of about 8 or so minutes.
Wow, that is a terrific interview. You use the word transactional philosophy. Can you explain that?
I think so. I look at your business and probably personal life as either theory or transaction. Action doesn't necessarily result in transaction. I think action is sometimes a frittered utilization of energy, because you can take a lot of actions that don't get you anywhere. I look at things trying to evolve to transactions that to me, a transaction produces a result.
Okay, so the trans part of the action there is when you connect up with something else.
Yeah, a lot of people get excited and they spend enormous amounts of time and effort preparing, contemplating. Years ago, I did a really expansive training program for people who wanted to learn how to do what I do. And I was fascinated and surprised by a number of people who spent an enormous amount of time getting their business cards ready and getting their letterhead and worrying about organizing their office instead of going out and getting clients, and then when they got clients, setting up programming, when they set up programming, implementing the programming, and when the programming works, improving the programming, and when the programming didn't work, replacing it with programming that did, and bringing things into process. And I think transaction, at least to me, I may be defining or explaining or interpreting it or applying it not 100% correctly, but transaction to me means when you put events into productive action that produces a result, as opposed to just dissipating and expending energy on activities that don't bring you anywhere.
Mm.
If you talk about real estate agents, which I learned it from them, they don't deal in what in time. They deal in how many transactions occur, how many people buy or sell a piece of property, not listings, but how many people bought a piece of property from you, how many people sold a piece of property from you, how many transactions did you close. And I think that's a good metaphoric illustration for all of us, because I think we talked in one of our programs about the fact that I don't particularly care about time or energy expended. I'm not one of these people who believes if you work 18 hours a day, you're going to succeed dramatically better. I have a lot of people who find it contemptuous that I sometimes work an hour a day. But the hour I work is extraordinarily concentrated, and it is leveraged to the highest level. It's the right hour. I'm getting the maximum, the optimal result from the time, the effort, and the forces and the resources I bring to bear. And everyone must recultivate or redefine their whole strategy on life to do the same.
Can you give any synonyms for the word transaction? Just broaden that a little bit. This is an incredible
idea.
Well,
okay, let's see. By transaction, to me at least, I am referring to the process you use of getting productive and profitable programming into action in your life. By that I mean bringing ideas off the paper or out of your mind into application and then into viable reality. And I think it differs for different people, but I just mean all the time you think about things and all the time you contemplate things is useless. The only thing that the society and the world values, respects, and pays you for are results. When you realize that the world is not cold and heartless, it's extraordinarily equitable. It doesn't care whether you spend an hour, it doesn't care whether you spend a lifetime. It doesn't care whether you're the most brilliant person in the world or whether you've got an IQ of 62. All the world cares about is what results do you produce? How do you perform? And I think that's the most wonderful opportunity we all have, because there's no political, there's no educational, there's no capital limits. It's just what do you do with the time and your opportunity?
Hmm. That's an incredible bit of philosophy. That kind of makes a person hone down to doing what pays.
Well, I mean, I've learned that you don't get paid in life for enthusiasm, you don't get paid in life for intellect, you don't get paid in life for education, you get paid in life only for the results you produce. And if you look at it, all of us in life are on a commission, whether we realize it or not. We get paid in proportion to the results we produce. If you're a salaried person, you don't get raises, you don't get promotions if you don't perform exceptionally higher than the level that is normality for that situation. If you are a business owner, if you perform at or below average, you are paid at or below average, aren't you? If
mm-hmm.
the results you produce for others are no better than the results your competitors produce, you probably don't produce any better, and oftentimes you produce a lesser income for yourself and a lesser success rate. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense.
Whole different way of looking at it, but to me, it's the most, maybe not immaculate, but the most elegantly efficient way of looking at your life as a paying proposition.
Okay. All right. Well, let's shift gears a little.
Sure.
Talk about some headline tests.
Okay. Well, as you know, from previous sessions we've done together, the headline or its equivalent in marketing, in advertising, in selling, in commercials is the ad for the ad. It can be as much as 80 or 90% of the effectiveness, and Marty, it can impact the outcome by as much as 21 times. That means that by changing your headline, by identifying and incorporating a more powerful, a more specific, a more results-denominated results to the in context of results that will accrue to the customer, not results for you, the advertiser, a results-denominated headline, you, the advertiser, or you, the marketer, could improve the yield, the result, the return, the performance of that ad, of that sales letter, of that commercial, of that sales presentation, or script, or telephone script, by as much as 2,100%. When you have that kind of leverage available to you in a world and in a business arena where there is virtually no other leverage, you've got to adhere, you've got to revere, you've got to respect, you've got to understand, and you've got to keenly be committed to testing and understanding all the nuances that that headlines can produce for you. So I'd like to share with you a little simple experiment that somebody else years ago in advertising did, because it'll show people the profound difference. First of all, I said headlines can make that big of a difference. And I told you what it is. Headlines aren't limited to print ads. As I said, you can use them in sales letters, commercials, sales presentations, anywhere else you need to grab your prospect's attention. So what I'll do is I'll read to you 10 different headline tests that were used in real advertising. Then I'll share with you the differential, so you can get an idea of what that might have meant if you were spending $10,000 on an ad, if you were spending $10,000 or $20,000 on a mailing, if you were spending $5,000 a month dispatching a salesperson in the field, or having telephone salespeople on the phone talking to people, or in your store, or in your facility, and they used the right or the wrong headline or opening to show you what the impact could be on your bottom line. This is from a display ad, so you're going to have to modify, and you have to be this extrapolator and say, well, what's the implication to me if I did it in an electronic commercial on the radio? What's the implication if I did it in a direct mail letter? Okay. Headline A was the following: push-button shave cream. Headline B, moisturized shave cream.
Mm.
Okay.
What was the difference there?
Headline A that said push-button shave cream pulled 200% more results than headline B. 200%. That's twice the number of customers, twice the number of sales, twice the amount of profit from the same fixed expense.
And what was the difference there in the thinking of the customer?
I think the difference, Marty, was the fact that one talked about an ease of usage, the other just talked about moist, but didn't. It was one was feature. Remember, we talked on one of our programs about feature and benefit. The feature is something most customers don't appreciate unless you transcend it or connect it to the benefit or the result it means to them.
Okay.
The first one is a result: push button shave cream. It's easy, turnkey. It's not messy. The other is moisturized shave cream. What does that mean to me? What's the relevancy?
And it was twice as effective.
Twice as effective.
Okay.
The next one, headline A: all leather handbags for only $28, parentheses. The last time we ran this ad, we sold out in 48 hours. The next one, this is the ad we had to cancel 3 months ago because we sold them so fast.
I'm trying to guess here before you say what happened.
You want me to tell you?
Yeah, please.
Headline B: this is the ad we had to cancel 3 months ago because we sold them out so fast. Outpulled headline A by 300%.
Why?
this one, I honestly, this is one of the most wonderful things about headline tests. Sometimes there's a nuance that I don't know. I don't know exactly, no, Marty. I know that the second one, this is the ad we had to cancel 3 months ago because we sold them out so fast, has more drama to it than A, but I'm not sure it has that much more. But the point I'm making is some of the greatest advertising masters in the world don't know which headline works best because they always, when a great copywriter or a great sales professional crafts an ad or a sales letter or a mailing program,
mm-hmm.
they will test two or three different ad headlines or headline openings in their test. They'll use the same body copy in two or three different tests because they don't even know. Experts don't even know. If experts don't even know, you can't begin to know. And when you're talking about variance or leverage or inverse leverage that could easily be 200 or 300% or 2100%, you have to test because you're leaving two or three times the profits, the sales, the return, the leads on the table if you do it wrong. Should I continue?
Yes, please.
Headline three. The first one is a headline test three. First headline, how to get your cooking bragged about. The second one, how to make your food taste better. What do you think pulled that?
I was afraid you were going to ask.
How to get your food bragged about, because I think people want to be respected and admired by other people. They want to look, they want to not, remember we did a session where I said no one wants to be average?
Yeah. What kind of percentage difference?
42% better. But look at what that could mean if you're in any kind of business where getting new, let's say you were a grocer, or let's say you were a cooking utensil retailers, and let's say that your goal was to get as many new customers because you knew every time you got one new customer, he or she would buy from you 20 times a year forever. What would it be worth to get 42% more people to come in the first time over a lifetime?
If people,
incalculable, Marty.
Yeah, if people listening just apply this a little bit, they easily will pay for the price of several subscriptions.
Yeah, for several lifetimes for several people.
Yeah.
But the point I'm making is I will keep doing this because I want to make, I don't want to just pass over this, is two things. Number one, you have to test. Number two, even the experts don't know what the differences are. Number three, usually but not always, specificity will outpull generalities. And what I think we'll do is when I'm done with this, I'll go back because we started one time doing headline points. And I think I'll go back to it in this session and do a couple more because I think it's a very powerful illustration.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, what was I? I was on three?
Yes.
Number four. This is the fourth test. The first headline, it's a question. Quote, my insurance company, New England Life, of course, why? Test B. The farsighted man from New England Life could show you how you could get 30 years of life insurance and then get back all the money you put in.
I'm going to quit guessing, Jay.
I would have guessed number B.
Yeah.
However, and this is me, and I'm pretty knowledgeable, number A outpulled B by 200%. This was a lead gen.
No kidding.
Why? I don't know. Point is, don't presume. See, the trick in the, remember I said, and it was in one of our previous, I don't know which one because we've done so many now, one of our previous programs, I told you that you don't have the right to prejudge for your marketplace. You don't have the right to make a decision based on conjecture. You have the obligation and the responsibility and the opportunity to let your market tell you. And if you ask the market, they will always tell you the right decision, the right approach, the right premise, the right pricing. And that's the most wonderful. You don't have to worry about it. You just have to ask them in test form. Experts don't know, Marty. If experts don't know, people who are striving to become more expert couldn't begin to know. So all they have to do, rather than be frustrated and make a bad decision, is ask their market. Doing a test is inexpensive, and it can be so conclusive. You can do tests so many different ways. You can do them through little postcards, 500 one way, 500 the other. You can do them through running split-run tests. A lot of publications let you run two different ads and every other copy they print in a newspaper or a magazine. You can try calling on the phone 50 people with one opening premise and 50 people with another. You can have your salespeople dispatched trying 20 different, 20 people one approach and 20 people another. You can have one salesperson try one approach and one try another. You can try on telephone calls the same way. It may not be absolutely definitive, but it will be indicative, and that indicative information will give you a higher probability of using the right headline or opening in any program you put a lot of effort or money or importance behind. Let me do some more.
Please.
Okay. This is copy test or headline test 5. The first headline is the gift that comes 12 times a year. The second one, how to do your Christmas shopping in 5 minutes. Which one do you think pulled more?
I'm not hitting real well. Let's go with B.
B absolutely is the winner. It pulled 90% more revenue. Now think about this, Marty. If you send a letter, let's say you send 1,000 letters. The wrong letter produces $1,000. The right letter produces $1,900. Look at what you, that's only on the first transaction. If you're doing any kind of business where you have repeat, you got 90% more customers out of that transaction just by changing the premise, changing the opening.
Is it hard to keep this open mind and learning attitude?
I think it shouldn't be when you realize, I've always, rather than trying to teach what to do, I've always tried to give you a different premise or give people. I did a lot of work with Anthony Robbins a while back, and what I learned from him was pretty interesting. What I learned was simply this. People do more to get pleasure and avoid pain. And if I say to you, you're going to look back on your life, Marty, in regret and say that everything I did I could have done, I could have gotten 5 times the short term and probably 12 or 15 times the long term benefit out of by doing it differently, and differently would have been easier and less risky and more fun, but I didn't choose to do that, that's pretty pathetic, isn't it? That's how I would look at it if I were the listener.
Okay.
I would never allow myself. Every day I'd say, am I doing this the smartest way, the optimal way? Am I getting the most yield for the least risk for the least time? Am I getting the most residual value? If I'm not, what questions do I have to ask the market? Keep in mind, the quality of your life is in direct proportion, and the success of your life or your business is in direct proportion to the quality of the questions you ask yourself and others, and the quality and the clarity, and also the quality and the clarity of the questions you ask yourself and others, and the quality and the clarity of the answers you get back.
Questions.
And testing is nothing more than questioning your marketplace, throwing your suppositions to them, because you don't have the... No individual, even the brightest people, I can tell you, the smartest people, people who make $1 million a year writing headlines, don't know the answer. That's why they test. Reader's Digest for years would test headlines in little postcards before they would ever put them on a 10 million run of a magazine, because they knew the difference between one headline and a different could make a difference in selling an extra 500,000 copies at newsstand. The National Enquirer has a full-time headline writer who writes the teaser on the outside of the issue.
Okay.
That man or woman is paid like $200,000 a year just for writing headlines.
Is that right?
And why do you think they do that? You think that they're promiscuous and they're wasteful and they're indulgent? Or you think that they know something that most people listening to this tape don't know? Should we do another one?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, headline test 6, question A. What is buffered aspirin? Headline B. How to stop a headache without upsetting your stomach?
B.
B was the winner by 50%. 50% doesn't sound like a lot, but again, if you're getting customers who are going to buy many times a year forever, what is it worth to you over forever to get 50% more new people in the door, figuratively or literally speaking?
Basically, you're getting that additional 50% for no added outlay.
Or you could say it differently. Some of these ads that pull 3 times better than the other, the headlines,
mm-hmm.
You could actually run 1/3 the size ad and pull the same yield that you're currently getting for the same investment. There's a lot of ways of looking at it.
Hmm.
I had a really interesting, by the way, there's another a nuance that I'll share now. When you run ads, particularly display ads, if you decide you want to run a full-page ad, but all you really have to put in there is a quarter page's worth of copy, all you have done is increase the cost per sale or per customer or per lead by 4 times. And in other words, all you're doing is indulging your ego if you take an ad that should only be a quarter page in size and blow it up to a full page. And you think you're really smart because you're getting attention. Well, you're really dumb because what you're doing is you're paying 4 times the cost. You'd be much better off running 4 quarter-page ads in the publication with different headlines and different premises. You'd get a lot more bang for your buck than you would taking a quarter page's worth of ad and putting it in a full page worth of space. Does that make sense?
Makes sense.
These are pretty interesting and simple, and when I utter them, they're probably most of them are pretty evident, aren't they?
Well, well, once you explain it, it kind of falls out, but it's
let's,
brand
let's
new.
Let's do another one.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, this is copy test or headline test 7. First headline, dry up hay fever. The next one was just hay fever.
Okay, I don't know if this will be a trick one or not. Dry up hay fever.
That's true. It outpulled the other by 27%.
Hmm.
I think it's because it showed a transaction that applied to a specific response. Hay fever, just ask anybody if you suffered.
Mm-hmm.
This one promised a relief, a result, transactionally. Remember we talked about that?
Right, right.
Benefit?
Right. Jay, let me ask you, how important are headlines?
I would say this, Marty. Headlines probably, and it's all of its equivalents, including its application to sales presentation, it's up to 80 or 90% of the success factor of what you're doing because the headline embodies the result, the promise, the payoff, the transactional benefit the customer gets. And remember, a headline is not just a headline in its literal sense. It's not just the big, bold phrase that appears in the beginning of an ad. It's also the opening phrase you utter in a commercial. It's the opening premise you state when you're encountering a sales prospect live on the phone in your facilities. If you don't understand it, you're leaving potentially 21 times the business, the success, the customers, the flow of new customers, the residual value on the table, and it translates everywhere. And if you understand it in one medium, it translates and is universally applicable. I would say of all the areas people should work on to learn in tactical or technique-based marketing, headlining or its equivalent or opening premises or positioning and denominating the result and the benefit to the customers should be all important.
Okay, how do you learn that? What are the rules?
Well, there's a lot of rules. Remember, I think I started by sharing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or so headlines on one of the edges. I think what I'd like to do in reverence to and acknowledgement of the importance is maybe do a real quick litany of a bunch of different factors. I've got in front of me a collection from my own files of great headlines and some explanatory statements. I could go through a very quick, probably 15 or 20 minute overview of them, and I think it'd be very valuable for the people.
It sounds like this is the fulcrum of fulcrums.
It really is. It changes your whole strategic understanding of the way to really get leverage on your efforts in any marketing context you might do, in any marketing action, whether it be a letter, whether it be an advertisement, whether it be a telephone call, whether it be a postcard, whether it be a sign that you put on at a display at a trade show, in front of your store, on a truck, on a billboard. These techniques are universally applicable, and they're so significant and profound and key leverage factors that failure to understand them is denying yourself or limiting or restricting the level of success your company could reap.
Okay, let's do more on side two of The Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham.